Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, John Dennis back at the helm of News Desk, Guardian Unlimited's daily audio show on Monday, August the 6th. Today, the investigation into what caused an outbreak of foot and mouth disease in southern England is focusing on the possibility of human error in a nearby laboratory. And you'll hear what farmers have to say about that. Also today, F.W. de Klerk is under renewed pressure over the campaign of assassinations, torture and bombings carried out by the state when he was president of apartheid South Africa. At the Edinburgh Festival, mainstream comedy is taking over. That's the fear of those involved in the more experimental artistic endeavours on the festival's fringe. And you'll hear the astronomer and sometime rock guitarist Brian May talk about the heavens. And we'll be looking at how the city of Durham looks under the sky at night. And here in the pod to shed light on today's papers is Ros Taylor. Derek Pride runs Walford's farm in Elstead near Guildford in Surrey, and his farm is at the centre of the outbreak of foot and mouth disease. He told The Guardian he's devastated at what's happened and insisted he's done no wrong. John Vidal is our environment editor. I asked him what's happened since the virus was detected at the end of last week.
Right back to the beginning, Thursday night last week, there was a suspect case, and this was confirmed on Friday night, 9:30. Saturday morning, tremendous panic in Defra, wheels going to action. Where on earth did this come from? Everybody just looked at the map and realised that 3 miles away from the outbreak was Britain's leading biomedical centre, where they actually make the vaccines to counter foot and mouth disease.
How might it have been possible for a virus in this laboratory in Purbeck, Bright in Surrey, to escape and reach the herd of this farmer Derek Pride?
Well, that's a million-dollar question. In theory, very, very difficult. This is security level 5. On the other hand, it's a 1940s building. Things go wrong, and it is possible there are 4 or 5 routes out. One is through ventilation. One is through on the clothing of individuals who are there. Conceivably, rats or mice or whatever could have taken it out. There's different ways it could have got out.
It's not just this private pharmaceutical firm, Merial Animal Health, that works at Purbright. There's also the government's Institute for Animal Health. How do the two work together?
This used to be the government's leading laboratory, and then it was part privatised, and they invited in Merial Animal Health, which is an American organised company, and the two share their facilities. They work in different operations, but it's the same campus, it's the same site, and they have different scientists all working on different things. Basically, Merial make the vaccines, and every virus around the world, from any foot and mouth disease or anything else, is sent to Purbright, and so they just get the one from the other. So they work very, very closely with each other.
And how has the government reacted to this outbreak?
Farmers would say very, very well indeed. I mean, I was talking to some on Saturday afternoon, and what they wanted to see was very strong, immediate reaction and leadership. The last time, 2001, there was this awful delay. They couldn't decide about movements of animals and things like that, which undoubtedly led to the spread of the whole thing. This time they did clamp down very, very, very fast indeed. But the question then is, if this particular laboratory is the fault, then the government is at fault itself. The government owns this laboratory. So is it the government which is giving the farmers the same thing? Is it the government which is giving us foot and mouth? And I spoke to one yesterday who said, the danger is not with foot and mouth, the danger is with the government.
Both the Institute for Animal Health and Merial say that biosecurity procedures have not been breached, but are there any other lines of inquiry as to the cause?
First of all, they would say that, wouldn't they? Because obviously, there may well be very, very enormous legal consequences of an outbreak being very, very closely defined to a corporation or to the government. So that's the one thing. Of course, they're going to say that we will get a preliminary result of the government's own investigation, maybe late this evening, but I suspect tomorrow. And the other lines of investigation, well, there's no other outbreaks. I mean, there have been half a dozen people have phoned in saying, yes, we're a bit worried about our cows or our sheep or whatever, come and have a look, and they've been tested and nothing has been found. So at the moment, it's absolutely fingers crossed. And if it stays like that, then with a bit of luck, they'll get away with it. The good news is that because this was a vaccinated virus, in other words, it was one made by humans, it's not as virulent as it would be if it would come in on the wind or something like that. So hopefully it won't be as powerful, and hopefully it won't have got as far. On the other hand, the wind has been blowing quite a long distance. How come it was there and not 1 mile away or 2 miles down the road? No one knows yet.
There's a ban on the transportation of animals in place at the moment. Mm. How long before that affects Britain's food supply?
Very, very good question. We don't know. The answer is that there's lots of stocks and things like that, but no animals are going to the slaughterhouse, so you could get some little hiccups at the end of the week. If it were to go on, then you have the real problem starting. If there's nothing else comes forward in the next week, then they will probably uncross their fingers and say, we've got away with it.
That's John Vidal. Well, Sarah Birchall is an agriculture journalist who lives and works on a farm in Hertfordshire that specialises in rare breeds. She told me what life was like for farmers during the last outbreak of foot and mouth back in 2001.
It was absolutely terrible. It was a very large outbreak. It spread very swiftly to all parts of the country. At that time, I lived in Northumberland, and we were in the protection zone, and it spread very rapidly. There were no movements. It was a very heavy livestock area, so you didn't really dare go out even to the shops because you were so worried about spreading it to somebody else. You waited for the phone to ring, to perhaps be one of your neighbours to say, oh, we're not sure about something, we've got DEFRA coming. That happened 3 times to us, and 3 times we got the all clear, which was a big relief, because had our neighbours gone down, then we would have gone down, because at that point the contiguous culling was a very fierce policy of DEFRA. But the fear never left us, and that's the one thing about this epidemic, is that everybody since Friday night in the farming industry, whether they were affected last time or not, is terribly fearful. It just uncovered and reopened trauma and stresses that we all thought had perhaps been long buried.
What do you think of the way the government has responded this time?
They've learnt that it's essential to ban movements as fast as possible, which they've done. And I think the whole industry is happy with that. However, if it is found to be just one isolated case near to Pirbright and nowhere else, then perhaps, you know, some movement in other areas, and particularly movement to slaughter under licence in unaffected parts of the country, must be considered as soon as possible. I'm presuming that, you know, we're going to have lost our export markets for a while. This is going to depress prices, perhaps bring in more imports. The effect on trade across the whole industry, not just farmers, but abattoirs, auction markets, they can't trade. They'll have wages to pay. Farm shops have built up business with quality produce and low food miles. They'll be drastically affected unless stock is going to be allowed for slaughter. And if there really is a 28 total ban of all movements, I don't know how the supply of meat will be maintained.
If it does turn out that this outbreak was the result of human error, what will be the reaction among farmers?
Well, terrific outrage and anger. And there's already terrific outrage and anger. And there are a lot of denials going on. And one wonders really whether, in the end, it'll just be put down to an accident.
Sarah Birchall. Now, Ros Taylor's here with today's papers. Ros, what are they saying about Gordon Brown's handling of the foot and mouth crisis?
Well, he's had a lot to deal with this summer, with the floods and so on, and the papers are pretty happy with his reaction to the foot and mouth outbreak. Of course, he's cut short his holiday, come back and held emergency COBRA meetings. The Telegraph is less happy with Hilary Benn, the new Environment Secretary. He, of course, is a vegetarian, and the Telegraph wants to know what exactly he knows about farmers and what they care about. But the Telegraph is really the exception. The Times, especially, and The Guardian are paint a pretty favourable picture of how Brown has handled the crisis.
David Cameron, the Conservative Party leader, also cut short his holiday. What are they saying about his response to the crisis?
Well, David Cameron's had a very, very bad few weeks. Lots of negative publicity, and it just carries on today. The Times has a real go at him for implying that the government is at fault is behind this outbreak, even though there's no proof of that yet. And it calls him crude and crass. The Independent has a picture of him as a bull, which is suffering from foot in mouth disease.
The Times has got a story about the driving age possibly being raised to 18.
Yes, about 50,000 teenagers apparently passed their driving test when they've had less than 6 months driving experience and they're still 17. The Times says the Department of Transport wants to force a 12-month probationary period on them if they start their lessons as soon as they turn 17, and so they wouldn't be able to get a full licence until they were 18. The department says that it's done some research into this and it believes that it could save 1,000 lives each year and many more serious injuries. And the Times is pretty positive about this. It says that the principal cause of these accidents of this age is actually inexperience. All too often, the first time that they drive at night is to transport a number of friends back from a local public house after closing time.
A familiar story at this time of year, Roz. How A-levels ain't what they used to be.
Well, A-level results not far off, and of course the usual crop of stories about declining standards. The Telegraph weighs in today with a Durham University report saying that an A grade now is only worth a C grade back in 1998, and in maths only worth a D grade.
Lord Maddock Brown, Foreign Office advisor to Gordon Brown, is proving to be a bit of a wild card, isn't he?
He is, indeed, and he's made more enemies today, the Sun and the Times, by suggesting that the Britain should give up its seat at the UN and there should be an EU seat. You can imagine what the Sun and the Times think about that. Erwin Seltzer, who's a close confidant of Rupert Murdoch, has already described Lord Maddock Brown's appointment as appalling, and both papers have a go at him for imagining that the EU can adequately represent our interests at the UN.
Now, these incredible floods have swept South Asia, hundreds killed and 20 million displaced. Extraordinary figures, Ros.
These floods are even worse than usual. Two-thirds of Bangladesh has been inundated this year. Of course, most of the country is a floodplain, and that's important for farmers. But the reason for this extraordinary influx of water, the Times says, is probably due to global warming, because the water has been coming off snowmelt on the Himalayas and swelling the Ganges and Brahmaputra rivers, and that has created vast, vast amounts of flooding. In fact, UNICEF is worried now that there will be outbreaks of measles, malaria, gastroenteritis, all these diseases associated with dirty water.
Now, people who haven't paid their court fines might be stopped from going abroad.
If the government's e-border scheme works properly, they will be, because it will enable the government to match up court records with passports and so on. And so what it wants to do is to stop people going on their holidays if they owe the courts money. The other people who could suffer from this are those who've been accused of air raid, and also people who falsely claim that they don't live in the UK in order to avoid paying UK income tax.
Vultures, not often seen in France, but apparently this summer there's been a few sightings.
Well, there's a great first paragraph in the Times today, really chilling. It says, when a French pensioner died of a brain hemorrhage during a walk in the Pyrenees this summer, vultures started circling low over his body. And the pensioner's friends managed to wave the birds away. But apparently there are more and more vulture attacks on animals in the French Pyrenees, and that is because of a new EU regulation, which means that, yes, you might have guessed, which means that Spain isn't leaving out carcasses anymore to rot. Of course, the vultures like to come in and scavenge those. Instead, the carcasses are being burnt, and that means the vultures have to look elsewhere for their food.
Well, thanks for that, Roz, and thanks also for presenting Newsdesk while I was away. And thanks too to Matt Wells, Riazat Butt, Hugh Muir, Matt Weaver and Alok Jar. Alok, of course, a presenter of our Science Weekly podcast, which this week features this. Brian May, of course, best known for that in his capacity as guitarist with Queen, but he's just completed a PhD entitled Radial Velocities in the Zodiacal Dust Cloud. I think I've got that right. He began it in the 1970s, but he's only just got round to completing it. Science Weekly's Ben Green met Brian May at Imperial College in London and asked him to tell us about the relationship between science and music.
A lot of the great astronomers have been musicians and vice versa. Don't know why that should be exactly, but there does seem to be a similar kind of harmony which you seek in both. I don't know if I can put it any more succinctly than that, but astronomy and music definitely go together, just as Patrick Moore's introduction to his Sky at Night always moves you to contemplate the heavens. There is something that inside us gets triggered, I think, by music and astronomy, sort of contemplating the infinite, I suppose.
If you were given the choice of a guitar or your telescope, what would it be?
Oh, a choice of one That would be very difficult. That would be too hard. I think that schools in general tend to make us specialise too much, and I feel like I'm holding a banner for the fact that you can be broad and you can be passionate about more than one part of the pursuit of knowledge or the pursuit of art. I like the fact that I perhaps seem to have chosen music over science, but it was never gone from my insides. It was always there. I was always very, very keen. So I'm very lucky that I can do both now.
Brian May. And there's more of that on our Science Weekly podcast at guardian.co.uk/podcasts. In 1993 in Transkei, five teenage boys were killed by a South African military hit squad. They'd said it was a Pan-Africanist Congress safe house being used to plan what they described as terrorist attacks. But it emerged the boys were unarmed and they were shot dead in their beds. Just days later, South Africa's last white president, F.W. de Klerk, received the Nobel Peace Prize for his role in helping to dismantle apartheid. Our South Africa correspondent Chris McGreal told me why this has now returned to haunt Mr. de Klerk.
In part because one of his own ministers, the former law and order minister Adrian Flock, has been charged with the attempted murder of a former cleric who was a major anti-apartheid leader, Frank Chikane. As a cabinet minister, as law and order minister, Flock ordered that Chikane be murdered in 1989. In fact, what happened was his underpants were laced with poison. It made Chikane very ill, but Chikane did survive. That Flock never applied for amnesty at the time from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and so he's subsequently been charged with attempted murder. But that has opened a whole can of worms, because essentially what's happened is that the press here has started to look at why it was that only Flock applied for amnesty for other crimes, why he's the only one that's been charged now, and really whether these decisions such as that to kill Frank Chikane went further up the chain of command, ultimately to Mr. de Klerk, who was president at the time.
Do people believe Mr. de Klerk when he says that he didn't know about the state's illegal activities such as police and military hit squads?
I think a lot of people find it very difficult to believe. I mean, he sat not only in cabinet for a number of years, but from 1985 he sat in the State Security Cabinet. Now, the State Security Cabinet considered a number of requests from the military to kill people. There are memos from the military regarding, for instance, one Matthew Ganiwe. The State Security Cabinet made a decision to remove Ganiwe. That was the word that was used. De Klerk now says that simply meant he should be moved from one place to another, but Ganiwe was subsequently killed. There are a number of other instances like this. And whilst De Klerk says that all that was meant by these was a relatively innocent measure against pretty vigorous anti-apartheid activists, I think that most people are very sceptical that he could be a member of the State Security Cabinet, that he could be a president of the country and not know that any of this was going on.
Wasn't South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission supposed to lay to rest the many crimes and injustices of apartheid?
That was the idea, but what essentially happened was that whilst many of the operatives who were responsible for these murders did apply and got amnesty, more than 800 people got amnesty on both sides of the conflict, the most senior people simply didn't apply for amnesty. President P.W. Botha simply refused to appear before and was charged with contempt. De Klerk appeared but spent most of his time simply denying any knowledge. And in fact, there was at one point during the hearings, he lost his temper, banging his fist on the desk and eventually walked out when he was confronted with a whole list of killings, bombings and other atrocities that he was, according to the lawyers for the TRC, must surely have known about. Again, he didn't apply for amnesty. Ironically, the only person who did and who received amnesty for bombings and others was Adrian Flock, who's the man who now faces the attempted murder charge for the attempt to kill Frank Chikane.
Chris, many thanks. The Edinburgh Festival is in full swing, and there's been some criticism of the presence of big-name entertainers such as Ricky Gervais, Frank Skinner and Jimmy Carr on the fringe, which is supposed to be the domain of more esoteric and radical performances. I asked arts correspondent Charlotte Higgins how comedy is taking over the fringe.
In fact, I think it's a sort of slow accretion over the years. Comedy has become more and more popular at the fringe. And people hark back to a possibly non-existent golden age where it was all about experimental and avant-garde theatre. This year, I suppose, people are getting a little bit upset about the fact that very well-known, well-off comics like Ricky Gervais are coming in and doing one-off shows, and Gervais is charging £37.50 for an hour-long show. And that seems to be overshadowing the sort of more interesting, more experimental theatre work.
But presumably there is still a fair amount of, your experimental theatre, your badly funded productions kind of just about subsisting. I mean, tell us what is going on the fringe that you think the sort of stuff that is being drowned out.
Well, there's always very interesting work at a small venue called Aurora Nova, specialises in physical theatre, dance and avant-garde theatre. And that's doing all kinds of interesting stuff, much of which sounds pretty peculiar, but I'm very hopeful that some of it's going to be terribly interesting. There's a show, for instance, by a Polish company called Song of the Goat Theatre called Lacrimosa. And a couple of years back, they did a show here which was just absolutely marvellous and by word of mouth became a popular hit. So that can still happen. And, of course, if you're up on the fringe interested in going to see theatre, it's the holy grail to find a really terrific little show that's just bubbling up.
As arts correspondent, Charlotte, do you dread Edinburgh? Is it just a bit overwhelming? Or is it the potential of a holy grail keep you going?
That's exciting about Edinburgh. There are so many things going on. There are 2,000 shows at the Fringe alone. There's the film festival, the book festival, the international festival. In a sense, you become your own curator and navigate your way through this kind of maze of things. So there is this exciting sense of discovery, although there's often quite a lot of disappointment en route as you take risks on shows and they turn out to be not as you had hoped.
Charlotte, many thanks. And if that's not enough Edinburgh for you...
Hello!
I'm Brian Logan.
And I'm Lucy Porter.
And we're presenting The Heckled, the Guardian's daily comedy podcast from the Edinburgh Festival.
Oh yes, we'll be here every weekday for the whole 3 weeks.
We'll be bringing you top names in comedy, discovering new and up-and-coming talents, and bringing you sights, sounds and smells of the fringe experience.
Come here! So join us every day for The Heckled. It's your festival fix.
Deciding how a city is lit at night is not only about safety or about showcasing its architectural wonders, it's also about reducing light pollution. In the beautiful city of Durham in northeast England, our correspondent snuck down an alleyway to find out more.
This is Martin Wainwright reporting for Guardian Unlimited from a Vennel. You probably don't know what a Vennel is, and I didn't until this evening, but it's an alleyway or a snicket or a ginnel or a snickleway in the city of Durham. And these little narrow winding medieval paths are central to something very interesting which Durham is doing. I've got Harvey Dowdy here, who's from the regeneration organisation Durham 2020 Vision, who's going to explain. What are you up to here in Durham, Harvey?
We're up to looking at lighting and darkness, and we've developed a strategy for lighting and darkness. And we want to find different ways of lighting up different parts of the city. It's partly to do with sustainability and saving money, but it's also opening up bits of the city that you can't normally get to at night because they're dark. And one of the things we're looking at are these snickleways that run across the city.
And you're spending a lot of money on this. It's about, or just over, £3 million. And when someone like myself comes to Durham, you straight away see the two World Heritage sites, the cathedral and then next door to it, the castle, are both lit up. How are you going to produce something different from that sort of traditional floodlighting?
It's not possibly, to the outside observer, going to look that different. And that's the interesting part about it, is the subtlety that's involved. It's not just about the big world monuments, it's also about the legibility of the city as a whole. So that instead of just focusing on the cathedral and the castle, you get drawn into other bits of the city and you feel you want to explore them.
This scheme will involve a lot of new lighting, but also taking out of existing lighting. I'm just walking through the marketplace, and there's a lot of very conventional flood lighting, you know, bright lights shining upwards on the facades of shops, and some rather powerful street lights that create a pool of light around themselves but don't do much else. The lightness and dark scheme will regularise that with a whole lot of new street lighting, and this rather clever use of areas of shade, pools of darkness, which can, if necessary, be lit. If it's a dark place where somebody might be scared, the lighting can be organised so that it will detect that somebody's there and it will gradually come on.
Martin Wainwright. Today's edition of News Desk was produced by Ian Chambers and Phil Maynard. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.